You're listening to This Song, the podcast where artists talk about the songs that formed and transformed them. I'm your host, Elizabeth McQueen, and this week on This Song, you're going to hear from musician, writer, and frontman for Old 97's Rhett Miller. It's a rerun of an episode we did back in 2017, but it seems like a good time for you to hear it again because Rhett Miller recently released his own podcast. It's called Wheels Off with Rhett Miller, and in it he talks to artists like Roseanne Cash and Fred Armisen about, and this is in the words of the official podcast description, the messy reality of a creative life. Like, how does someone make a living? By making things, by taking ideas from their imagination and then manifesting them into reality. It's not easy. It's always complicated. And, you know, it's pretty well known among people who interview other people, like me, that Rhett Miller is a great interviewee. You'll hear that in this episode. But it turns out he's also a great interviewer. And you'll hear that when you listen to his podcast. In case you're like, yes, but who exactly is Rhett Miller? Let me tell you really quickly. He's a singer and a songwriter and a guitar player. And since the early 90s, he's fronted the Dallas-based Americana band Old 97s. He's recorded and toured consistently with that band since then, while also releasing a slew of solo records. Earlier this year, he released a children's book called No More Poems, a book in verse that just gets worse. And at the beginning of this year, Rhett Miller also launched the podcast I was just telling you about, called Wheels Off. Y'all, the guy is, like, busy. I spoke to Rhett Miller back in 2017, right after he played with Old 97s in Studio 1A, which is the gorgeous live performance studio here at KTX, the radio station in Austin, Texas, where we make this podcast. And he told me about a song that he heard as a kid that changed his life by showing him the power of musical connection.
So that's a funny question, because music is a part of my earliest memories, you know, and there are moments that seem really huge in my life that I connect to all sorts of songs. And it was hard for me to narrow it down to one, but when you presented the question, I went to a moment that if I had been given a week to think about this, I would never have settled on this moment maybe, but it was so instinctive. This memory, it was my 14th birthday, and I had already started writing songs, and I already loved music and was learning to play guitar and had sort of developed some of my own tastes. And I went to see the Smiths tour behind the Queen Is Dead album.
And if a double-decker bus crashes into us, to die by your side is such a heavenly way to die.
And it was my birthday, and it was at the Bronco Bowl in Dallas, and it was a really cool night. It was one of the first real nights that I feel like I'd been out as like a young man. And they brought out their opening act, and it was someone I'd never heard of. It was a woman from Southern California, a folk singer by the name of Frank, with a PH and a hard C. And she, you know, she was self-described as a Jewish lesbian folk singer named Frank.
When I walk down the street, it's right there in front of me. It's a great big poster on the telephone pole, and it says female mud wrestling.
Ooh. And I'd never heard of her. And she walked out on stage in front of, what, 3,500, 4,000 people with just an acoustic guitar. And she played a few songs that were so funny. And I was immediately drawn in.
Female mud wrestling. Female mud wrestling.
And it's weird never having seen a person before, and especially when you're waiting for the headliner, which at the moment was one of my very favorite bands. And there she was, and she was owning this huge room. And here we're talking about Dallas, Texas in the 80s, where, you know, a Southern California Jewish lesbian folk singer is not like a super obvious, you know, going to go over gangbusters in a large setting like this. And she was owning it, and she was playing these funny songs, and she's going through all this stuff.
And everywhere I go, I hear the go-go's. Everywhere I go, I hear them sing. Everywhere I go, I hear the go-go's. People in sports cars doing their thing.
And then towards the end of her set, I don't think she closed with it, but I think it was her penultimate song, which is sort of a special, I've discovered, a special place in the set list, you know. She played a Dylan song. And Dylan, I did know, but I didn't appreciate like I would later when I would read an interview with Michael Stipe where he talked about Highway 61 is one of the great albums of all time. And I'd go back and really rediscover Dylan as like as a writer, you know, and because when I'd first found him, I wasn't really a writer yet. So I just was letting it wash over me. And it seemed like too much at the time. So she goes into The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll.
Williams and Singer killed poor Hattie Carroll with a cane that he twirled around his diamond ring finger at a Baltimore hotel society gathering, and the cops were called in, and his weapon took from him as they rode him in custody down to the station and booked Williams and Singer for first degree murder.
There she was, this woman that I'd never heard of before, and she was singing a song that went on and on. The story emerges as this really brutal story of a wealthy man who's born into an entitled position and in a very flip moment kills one of his servants over dinner. And the punishment that's meted out to him eventually in the final verse of the song is a slap on the wrist.
In a courtroom of honor, the judge pounded his gavel to show that all's equal and that the courts are on the level, that even the nobles get properly saddled. For once that the cops have chased after and caught 'em, and the ladder of the law has no top and no bottom. Stared at this person who killed for no reason, who just happened to be feeling that way without warning, and he spoke through his cloak most deep and distinguished, and handed out strongly for penalty and repentance for Williams and Singer with a 6-month sentence.
And then he gets to the it's like a truncated end of verse chorus. It's like a mini chorus. And he goes, and you who philosophize disgrace and criticize all fears.
All but you who philosophize disgrace and criticize all fear. Bury your face deep in the rag. For now is the time for your tears.
And he goes from being a shotgun deliverer of facts and names and events to being someone who's really connecting with the listener on a I am talking to you level, and it was so heartbreaking and it was so beautiful.
So connection was the huge thing that you kind of like maybe understood or started to understand when you saw that. I mean, you saw Frank connecting with the audience, and then you heard Dylan connecting with the listener. I mean, you said you were already writing songs at the time. I mean, do you think that there was any kind of like shift after you heard that? Like, I mean, what kind of songs were you writing around that time or before that performance? 'Cause you were 14. So
yeah, I was 14, and that year was, I mean, that was a cocooning kind of a year. It was everything was changing. You know, I had learned to play enough guitar, and I'd realized that music was my future and you know, my calling or whatever. But that year was also really hard because with the sort of advent of music in my life, I had to give up a lot of other little dreams that I'd carried around. Like, I'd always thought that I would follow in my father's footsteps and play football, and I did play football 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th grade. And I really loved it, but I was getting pushed out by the kids whose testosterone pumped more rapidly than mine and whose muscles grew more quickly and bigger. And I loved it, but I felt more and more like an outsider. But for me, that year was really hard. I lost a lot of friends. I gave up a lot of my childhood dreams of athletic prowess. But I had this new thing looming out there. But it wasn't easy. You know, that was the year that I tried to kill myself. I had a real serious suicide attempt. And I came out of that, like literally came to in the hospital singing a song. And there was a horrible moment of disappointment and shame and embarrassment at having failed at this horrible thing I never should have tried to do. And as soon as I had taken all the pills and drank all the toxic substances, when it was too late, I realized that it was a horrible idea. And I started running to try and get away from it. And thank God it didn't work. And I lived, but I came out of that experience really in a new place, like realizing that the second part of my life was going to be really a beautiful, gratifying thing because I had found something I cared about and loved. And I knew that the people surrounding me didn't have that, you know, like all these kids were lost kids and they were worried about being popular or being accepted or, you know, and I worried about that stuff too a little bit, but in my heart, I knew I had this thing. I had I had found a true love, you know, music. Music means to me more than anything else because it connects us on a fundamental level that as much as I love all other forms of art, I just don't feel like they can do it.
I believe the same thing about music.
Yeah.
I do believe that music connects people in a different way. And I'd be interested to know what your thoughts about that. Like why? I have my own theories about why music does it, but I'd like to hear the Rip Miller theory about what's different about music.
I think there's something about it, its sort of pre-verbal nature, about how when my kids were in the womb, I would go up to my wife's belly and I would sing through all the layers of, you know, skin and everything. And I would sing to them. And they're the songs that I still sing every night. To my son, my oldest kid, I sing I Can't Help Falling in Love with You.
Wise men say only fools rush in, but I falling in love with you.
And there's just something about that sound. You don't know what it means, but you know it's love. Like it's not the meaning is the message. Like the meaning is this sound, this wash of feeling, and you just, it's like feeling taking form, you know? And so eventually I really love proper lyrics. I really love the actual words, but really at its heart, why I think music is so powerful is because you can feel it without speaking the language. With it, like if I hear a song in French that breaks my heart, it breaks my heart, you know? It doesn't matter that I'm getting one out of every eight words maybe, you know? So I don't, maybe it's that, maybe it's just, it's so fundamental.
Yeah. I mean, I think we probably, and we've talked about this before in this podcast, we probably musicked before we talked, like we communicated with each other through sounds. And it always surprises me like what, because it's just sound waves, you know, it's like waves moving through air, but how we are just wired in such a way that like can just physically affect us.
Yeah.
It's really...
It's magic,
it's
right?
It's magic. It's like the closest thing that we have to magic, I think.
And God, I think about it now when my kids were tiny and, you know, there'd be white noise machines and there's always the setting for the heartbeat, the whomp, 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 whomp. And I mean, that's the first music you hear, right? And that's as powerful as anything. It's just that incessant beat and the beat and the whoosh of the amniotic fluids. And I mean... That's the most beautiful music probably, right?
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
Music connects us on so many levels. Like the musician connects with the audience, the musicians connect with each other, the parent connects with a child. I mean, I am so grateful that I discovered it. I don't think I would have survived had I not.
Got a story about a girl I did. Big heart, but she ain't that big. Now she's mine most of the time. That's good enough for me.
And this is Wheels Off. It's an old 97 song that is the theme song for Rhett Miller's new podcast of the same name. If you want to hear people like John McCrae, the lead singer and songwriter from the band Cake, talk about what it's really like to live a creative life, then you should check out Wheels Off. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. You can also head to the show notes page for this episode to find a link to that podcast. And if you dug the song he talked about, The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll, well, John Prine talked to me for this podcast about how the original Bob Dylan version of that song changed his life. You can find a link to that episode on the show notes page for this episode as well, along with a Spotify playlist where you can hear all the songs we referenced in this episode all the way through. And if you dug what you just heard, then please leave a rating or a review for the podcast on iTunes. Or you can click the light bulb on NPR One, or you can just like tell a friend. We just want these stories to get to as many people as possible. And if you use Google Assistant or Google Home, you can find us always just by asking for us. Just ask for the This Song podcast from KUTX. And that's it. You have come to the end of another episode of This Song. This Song is a production of KUTX 98.9 in Austin, Texas. This episode was produced by David Sanger and me, Elizabeth McQueen. Thanks to Deidre Gott and Peter Babb and Todd Callahan for all they do for this podcast. And yes, it's true. Our theme song is Mahout by Austin's own Hard Proof. Right on. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time.